Remaker's Mark, Episode 19, When Harry Met Sally. Hello again, everyone, and welcome again to Remaker's Mark. Here we have part 2 of episode 19, where we are again discussing When Harry Met Sally. With me, as always, are my friends Andy Wicks. Andy, how are you doing, and what is the most embarrassing thing that you've either witnessed or participated in a restaurant?
I'm well, thank you. My most embarrassing memory of a restaurant didn't affect me a lot because I was a toddler at the time, but I have a memory of sitting in a booster seat in a booth at what I believe was a Baker's Square. For some reason, my mom placed me at the far edge of the bench seat instead of somewhere safely in the middle of the booth. And I remember rocking back and forth in the bench seat and then rocking right off the edge of the bench seat and suddenly being on the floor and seeing the feet of a waitress come running up to me to make sure I was okay.
It explains so much.
Yeah, exactly. And that's and then I found $5.
Nice. Always wraps it up. Nice. The aristocrats.
The aristocrats.
Jeremy Nielsen, how are you doing? And what is the most embarrassing thing that you've either witnessed or participated in a restaurant?
I'm doing quite well. Mine also is from a younger time. I was coming back from having my braces adjusted, and my mom would always take us out to eat afterwards as a thanks for letting me do this to your mouth and putting up with all the pain sort of treat. And so we went to Pizza Hut and we were eating pizza, and the family in the booth across from us had similar young children, and one of them proceeded to throw up all over the table and floor and our table. And so there were unchewed pieces of macaroni and cheese everywhere.
Tell me more.
Wow.
Wow. The only thing I can I remember distinctly thinking, they did not chew well.
They suck at chewing.
That's the first thing I could think of, so sorry everyone for that.
Sorry. Well, put a trigger warning in or something, I don't guess. Yeah. All right, cool. Lee Hookshot, what about you? How are you tonight, and what is the most embarrassing thing that you've either witnessed or participated in a restaurant?
I'm great, and mine is a vomit story too, although it wasn't me. I was out with some friend. I was in high school and we were out one night just kind of bored, and we decided to go to Godfather's. And one of the friends that I was with was among us kind of the greedy one and the gluttonous whatever. And he ate the pizza way too fast and drank too much Mellow Yellow, and somebody said something particularly funny, and up it came. So
that's awesome.
Completely ruined, like, all over the table. And wow. We were all laughing at him, of course, because we didn't have as much to eat, so we thought it was karma. So
wow. Yeah, Mellow Yellow gets you every time. There's your lesson right there.
Yep.
Wow. Awesome. Mark Josting, how about you? What's the most embarrassing thing that you've either witnessed or participated in a restaurant?
I'm well, thank you. And embarrassing isn't quite the right word for this one, but it did happen at a restaurant, although I was not actually there. And that's the reason that it's sad, is because it's it was a family dinner. My whole family was there, and eventually they realized that I was not, because they forgot to invite me. eventually, my sister called me.
How long did
she finally realized.
This is like and a half
we have
an hour.
A winner.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yikes. That happens. That happens to the best of us. All right. My name is Kyle Delahunt. I am the host here of Remakers Mark. Most embarrassing thing that I've either witnessed or participated in probably involves. So at a previous job, it was in downtown Minneapolis, and downtown Minneapolis, everything is in proximity to many happy hours. And we all sort of suffered together in a very challenging work environment. And so happy hours were plentiful. And there were many times where several beers were consumed and probably poor choices were made. There were spin the bottle games and there were the penis game. I don't know if you know the penis game, where you basically just say the word penis with increasing volume until you can't say it any longer.
Ike Johnson, so, if you're listening, this one's for you.
Yep, you got it. Here's to you, little Ike. So yes, we did some embarrassing things, but we learned from that, and I haven't done that in many, many moons. Thank God. Yes, so that is my most embarrassing thing that I've either witnessed or participated in a restaurant. All right, so before we continue on with our discussion of When Harry Met Sally, we want to thank our friends at Modern Antics for their promotional consideration.
Modern Antics produces and markets hugely interesting events in bars and other cool places. Upcoming, the 5th annual Minnesota Beard Off at First Avenue on Friday, April 18th, featuring music by Silverback Colony. Competition categories include full beard, long and short, partial beard, mustache, ladies beard, and freestyle. Proceeds from the Minnesota Beard Off benefit several local charities. Interested in other Modern Antics events? Check them out at modernantics.com or on Facebook and Twitter at Modern Antics.
All right. Thanks again to Modern Antics. We want to touch on some feedback that we received from our friends on Facebook and Twitter. So we put a call out and asking who our friends would recast in the Harry and Sally roles. So we got lots and lots of responses to that, which was awesome. So I'll try to fly through these here because there's so many. Our good friend Becca Williams said she's been mulling this over. I know, Andy, she was talking with you about it. She said front runners are Emma Stone or Emily Blunt and James Franco for Harry. Friend of the show, Kyle Hoff, who's participated before in the In Memoriam episode. I think he's dead serious on this. He said Billy Dee Williams and Carrie Fisher. So I like the age difference there.
I've never known him Billy to not D. be serious.
I'd watch that.
It's true. He's deadly serious always. And then Lawrence Lee of Nerd Night Duluth fame said, gender switch the roles and have Aubrey Plaza play Harriet. Which I like that. I did that myself. I like switched that. Up a little bit. And then from Twitter, Ben Reichelt at Ben Reich said Vince Vaughn and Leslie Mann. Paul Rudd would be good too, but too similar to other movies. Our friend Josh Freeman, who's helped us here many a time, said Ed Helms and Kate Hudson. Amy Adams or Jennifer Aniston would also be good. Brian Moen, creative consultant to the Mathis Hard Network here, suggested Emma Watson and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I really like Emma Watson. That's a good call. A little young, but I like it. And then he also said, could it be remade with a same-sex couple, which kind of started that thought process for me for my Maya Rudolph pick for Harry / Harriet or what have you. And he suggested maybe Neil Patrick Harris and someone else. So having it be a male same-sex couple, I went with a female same-sex couple. So thanks
if I was
for that.
Skewing with an older cast ensemble, I would have gone Neil Patrick Harris for my Harry pick regardless.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's a good one. He's fantastic. Amber Carter, friend of the show, said Jake Johnson from The New Girl and Ari Grainer, or for more mainstream, Emma Stone and Josh Radnor. She said, although let's be honest, the entire show of The New Girl is basically one big When Harry Met Sally, which Andy, I think you can speak to that. So yes, it sounded very similar to what Andy said. And then she said, or what if you went in the other direction and did a retirement version of When Harry Met Sally with Helen Mirren for Sally and Bill Nye for Harry? And that intrigues the hell
beautiful.
Out of me. Yeah,
I like that.
Yep, I want to see that like as a that whole too. Separate movie. I don't care if it's called this, but I just want to see them hanging out and getting to know each other and arguing and talking back and forth and then falling in love. And Bill Connell sort of rephrased my question in a way that I think a lot of people probably did, which is instead of who would you want to have recast, it was who do you want to watch faking an orgasm on screen? Fair enough, Bill.
Boils it down to its essence.
Boils it down to its essence, exactly. He said, given that, I'd vote Jennifer Lawrence, but acting-wise, it might be more interesting to have Elizabeth Moss and Paul Rudd, or maybe Amy Adams and Ed Helms. So all good picks there. Elizabeth Moss doesn't get a lot of attention, and she's really good. I like that. Brian Alm, who is at Brainloading, which is a great name. This is a hard one to recast, as Billy is the perfect casting, which we talked about a lot, actually. James McAvoy would work, but you'd have to dress him down a bit. And Maggie Gyllenhaal as Meg Ryan's character. That one was really good, and I like that a lot. That's a great pick. Jessica Nadeau, I think that's how you pronounce her name. Her Twitter handle is at Jessie Nader, but her last name is not Nader, and I wonder if she gets more people calling her Jessica Nader, but I think that's actually not her last name. So, Jessica,
she's
if you're listening.
She's the Jessinator.
She's the Jessinator. Yeah, there you go. I never thought of it that way. Funny. Huh. What do you know? She suggested Michael Cera and Lena Dunham, or Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Emma Stone, or Seth Rogen and Greta Gerwig. She said, that's a tough one. I agree. I absolutely agree. Good friend Eric Nelson suggested that it be set in London instead of New York City, where Steve Coogan takes the Billy Crystal role and perhaps Rosamund Pike for the Ryan role. So, yeah, that's awesome.
Steve Coogan
would love it.
I would love to see that, actually. Yeah, same thing. I don't care if it's this exact remake, but I would love to see that happen. Marley West suggested James Franco and Katherine Heigl. She's at Marley Renee. Friend of the show, Paul Tejan, suggested Kristen Wiig in the Carrie Fisher role, Thomas Lennon in the Bruno Kirby role, Jason Sudeikis and Kate Hudson for Harry and Sally. So another Jason Sudeikis vote. That's great. I'd like to see that.
Thomas Lennon would be a fantastic Bruno Kirby.
Who is he? I don't know Thomas Lennon.
He's from Reno 911. He's the main character.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Yeah, he goes way back to the state.
Yeah.
State.
Got it. He would be great.
Yeah.
Like he's been recast here, and I can't remember which movie.
We put him in something a while back.
Yeah. Nice. And then good friend of the show, Kate O'Reilly, who's at Clever Kate, said, I want to see Rose Byrne as Sally and Casey Affleck as Harry. It makes me realize that Casey Affleck doesn't get enough attention on this podcast.
Yeah, so seriously.
That's a great call.
Well, he's been voted on once or twice, but yeah, he's good.
Yep, agreed. And then
superior Affleck.
Indeed. And then maybe my favorite casting response of all time, which was Steve Skavnak, who's at Steve Skavnak. He suggested for the roles of Harry and Sally, respectively, me and Natalie Portman. That's awesome. And then Jeremy said, I can't believe I didn't think of that. And yeah,
he's got balls.
I'm right there with you. Yep, that's a good call. And then one other one, Jared, you want to tackle that one real quick?
Oh, sure. Just a conversation with a friend, Emily Waster, who is going to be presenting at Nerd Night as well on Muppet Babies.
Nice.
She chose, after a lengthy discussion where many names were thrown out, she finally decided on Elizabeth Banks and Adam Scott, which both were in my running as well, at one point or another.
Yep, that was my choice, Elizabeth Banks was. So, yep, good call. All right, so then let's do a quick overview of who we decided were the winners for our major characters from the previous episode's discussion. So the role of Jess, originally played by Bruno Kirby, we went with Mark's choice of Chris O'Dowd. The role of Marie, originally played by Carrie Fisher, we went with Jer's choice of Lauren Graham. In the role of Harry Burns, originally played by Billy Crystal, we went with Lee's choice of Zach Braff. Good one. And then in the role of Sally Albright, originally played by Meg Ryan, we went with Lee's choice again of Gillian Jacobs. So Lee, well done. You got half of them there, 2 of 4. Andy and I got shut straight out. But what can you do? So Lee, you're the big winner. I'm going to take the normal pick away from you because, again, we've democratized things. We went through the whole alphabet and we ended with M. And now we're returning back to A. But before we do so, before Andy picks the next movie, except we're not. Although you did, I think you picked this choice, right? You said this.
That's true. I kind of did. I forgot about that.
So what we're going to do before Andy picks, so he can still pick the one after this, is we're going to do something that we are calling Bizarro Remakers Mark. So right now in Remakers Mark, as I hope you know in listening to this, is that we take movies from the past and remake them in the present. We thought it would be really interesting to mix that up a little bit and basically flip that around. So we're going to take a movie from the modern era and think about how we would recast it and remake it in an old era. So the movie that we are going to be doing is the modern film Inception, directed by Christopher Nolan with Leonardo DiCaprio, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, lots of great performances. It's a modern film, but what we're going to do is think about how it would be remade and recast in an olden age. And what we're going to do is each of us is essentially going to pick an age to discuss how that would be remade and how that would be recast. So Lee could choose 1955, I could choose 1992. So we're going to kind of find our own time frames and discuss that, especially that's more pertinent on the recasting side, but the remaking side will be a little bit as well. But so the next movie will be Bizarro Remakers Mark's discussion of Inception. So I'm really looking forward to it. I can't wait to hear it. It's going to be I'm scared too, but in a good way.
Too.
So I think it's going to be really cool. That was going to be a special episode, but instead of doing our usual one episode, special episode, this seemed like it was a good fit for a kind of usual format, just flippity flippid. So I'm excited about that. All right. So Now we move on to the second part of our discussion of When Harry Met Sally. Generally speaking, this we talk about plot, tech, and filmmaking changes that we would make to this movie. But as we got together in our pre-production meeting, we didn't have a lot of changes that we wanted to make to this movie. In fact, we really talked a lot about how fantastic of a movie this was. And it's really the quintessential rom-com, which is romantic comedy, if you will. Or as Jer said, the quintessential mod rom-com, which I'm assuming stands for... or modern romantic comedy, right? Yeah,
that is correct. Right?
Okay, excellent, good. So, Jared, why don't you touch a little bit on that as far as kind of the boilerplate for the modern romantic comedy, and then we'll branch out as a bit on what makes the movie so good as well.
Well, we've made mention through the casting choices how much When Harry Met Sally became kind of the textbook on how to make a romantic comedy for filmmakers since then. And there are so many pieces of what are now in every romantic comedy, or nearly every one, that were done either for the very first time or just done so perfectly in When Harry Met Sally that everyone just sort of latched onto that and said, well, we're going to make a romantic comedy, so we need to have the best friend, and we need to have... the big fight at the end, and we need to have the stereotypical person who is sort of telling them what to do and giving them bad advice or good advice or whatever it is. And all of these different pieces of the romantic comedy that have essentially become just almost overused at this point. And in so many romantic comedies, those things just so look either so forced or so one-dimensional or just... they fall flat, and what we kind of said in pre-production is that When Harry Met Sally is so good for so many reasons, it's almost more than the sum of its parts. And so I guess the question that I would ask in thinking about that is, what is it that made When Harry Met Sally work so well? Why did all of these things that are nowadays so stereotypical, why did they work so perfectly in that movie? Is it because of the casting of Carrie Fisher and Bruno Kirby and Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal? Is it Rob Reiner's directing? Is it the writing? Is it just the time period in which it came out? It just everything just sort of worked in the late 80s, and that's what we wanted at that point. Why did that one work when so many other ones just seem so one-dimensional or trite or forced?
Yeah, that is a fantastic question, and one we will hopefully address in this episode. Mark, you mentioned one thing in particular, which is the timeless nature of When Harry Met Sally. Can you talk a little bit about that, and then especially in terms of how it could be dealt with in a remake and how that would help that?
Yeah. Sorry, I turned German for a second.
That's all right.
Okay. Yeah, timeless storyline. That's the thing that keeps popping into my head, but oddly enough, no complete sentences. anyway, I think that that what makes the storyline timeless is that it doesn't bother with anything external. It's just about the people. It doesn't try to do anything with the setting aside from make it, you know, New York, and you know the character of New York City is something that spans decades at least.
Yeah.
Can I jump in here, Mark?
Yeah, yeah.
The setting, and you brought up a point that just sparked something in my head. The setting in this movie compared to, let's say, Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
They're both New York City. But the setting in Taxi Driver, as we discussed, is almost a central character to what's going on in the story. Where in When Harry Met Sally, it provides a beautiful backdrop. You know, the scenes where they shot were, I think, were selected very intentionally to be very, you know, very, very pretty, very aesthetically pleasing. But it also just kind of allowed a framework for the story to play. It wasn't reliant on the setting. The setting kind of, in this instance, like, did its job and then got out of the way. Whereas in a movie like Taxi Driver, the characters are interacting with a setting, you know, almost every minute of the film in some way. You know, and if that makes sense, there's a much more kind of a give and take. It's not the right term. Much more of an interaction just between the characters and the setting in that movie versus When Harry Met Sally, when in the setting there just kind of allows things to happen without interference.
Yeah, they might as well have just called it the big city. You know what I mean? Like, it's the archetypal going from a smaller big city into the bigger big city. And so even just in that mention of, like, I'm going to New York, it established, like, you're going outside of your comfort zone, maybe. You're probably going to be, at first, maybe living underneath your means or living above your means. Like, you're going to have a little bit of a hard time making ends meet. I mean, so it's like, it then implies a series of struggles, that is, when you move to the big city, or a series of opportunities, too. But then they don't touch on New York specific stuff. You don't see them, you know, at a date at the Statue of Liberty or on Caprini Green, or is that right? Yeah. Anyways, no.
That's Chicago.
Oh, that's Chicago. What's Tavern on the Green? Sorry. You know, just like all these different things that are prototypical New York. You know, I mean, it's not checking off the things in New York that you do. There's no montages of them walking through Times Square. It just happens to be like this big city, right? And I think that's great. And I think so many movies tend to rely upon that as a character. And I think, you know, for Taxi Driver, it was the mood of that character. But here, it's not really necessary. And so I really appreciate that they did that, that they kept it open-ended, and that really added to the universality of that.
Well, I think that when, like, Taxi Driver, and we discussed this at length during the episode, that you couldn't visualize that movie not being in New York, and that plays to that movie's strength. And just the opposite, when Harry Met Sally, you could see that happening anywhere, and that plays to that movie's strength. And I think that's one of the valuable things about the movie, is that, like Mark said, it is timeless. It is placeless. It could happen in Europe. It could happen in the 80s. It could happen now. It could happen in the 50s. And besides the really horribly outdated wardrobe that they all wore, that movie could just as easily have completely taken place without changing a thing right now.
I would use as a modern comparison the movie Her, if you've seen that. The setting in that story is similar in that it presents just this kind of unknown, unnamed mega city that can be, well, it's futuristic, but you can kind of see it can be anywhere. It can make the story. So I think it lends in that movie a universality to it, like this does in When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah, I would add the lack of large scale plot events. Like they don't mention things on the news. They don't talk about certain politicians being elected or certain wars being fought. It takes place outside of a definite timeline, aside from, you know, the characters themselves.
Yep. Yeah. At one point, Harry mentions that he's a political consultant, but he doesn't go any farther than that. You know, doesn't even say for this, you know, this political candidate or anything like that.
Yeah.
Which I think would have taken away from it.
Yep. It's everything is painted with very broad strokes, and sometimes that can be, that ambiguity can kill things. Here, it was a huge strength. So just having, like, lawyer, political consultant, I mean, just all these things that they are, it doesn't define their character. It's just a plot thing that they throw in there so that it's like, okay, they have a job, you know, that's all there is. You know, maybe it's a high level job, maybe it's a high stress job. So it's like, you just establish something that is a little bit of information, and then you as the viewer fill in as much of that background information as you want to with that, which I think is really refreshing.
There's a great list on cracked.com website that is the top four or six or whatever it is, jobs in romantic comedies. And they just sort of talk about how, architects, just like you said, there's these ambiguous jobs that are real jobs, but they seem to be prevalent in romantic comedies. And I think the two top ones on the list are architect and owning a boutique shop. And, which, you think about it, how many romantic comedies, the lead guy is an architect, whatever that is. It means he's got a lot of money and a lot of free time, apparently. And then the woman seems to own some sort of eclectic boutique where she sells hats or, you know, handmade mugs or whatever it is. And
children's books.
Children's, yeah, exactly. Like, that's, it's so formulaic and it's so overused at this point.
Yep.
And When Harry Met Sally doesn't suffer from those things, because it doesn't matter. It's just, we need to give them a job probably, so let's give them something. But what they do doesn't matter to the story.
Yeah. One thing that's interesting to me is kind of the nature of relationship. You know, I think One thing that could be done a little bit differently, although it doesn't have to, and the original is not made worse for it or doesn't feel dated, but it's kind of just like some of the sexual freedom that is different now versus when that was originally made. Like, you know, I think, you know, 30 years ago, if you slept with a lot of people, you were promiscuous. And now I think it's, you know, it's not assumed that that's okay, but it's more open. It's more accepted that that's okay. Like, dating is very different. Sexual politics is very different than it was then. So I think, you know, having them kind of like hook up, if you will, earlier on, or I think when it does happen, it wouldn't necessarily have that same kind of weight now, potentially, than it did back then. I mean, I think they played it perfectly in the original. I just think that that's one thing that culture has changed a little bit, that it could be viewed slightly differently in the remake. I don't know. What do you think about that? Perfect.
I couldn't find my mute button. The conversation in the diner, I think, would look a lot different. And that whole, when Billy Crystal asked Meg Ryan, you know, how many guys she slept with, and then she kind of brings it back around on him, and the surprise that they both have for each other's answers. I think that the number one, if you rewrote it today, I think the answers would be different just for who the characters are and just for what would make sense in today's time. Like you said, I think it's just a different perception, a different reality that we're living in now, as opposed to 1988 or 9 or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Lee, you touched on briefly kind of this being a quintessential romantic comedy for you. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that? And, you know, you mentioned a couple other movies as well.
Sure. Well, I was thinking that When Harry Met Sally is, you know, has become the quintessential romantic comedy alongside of It Happened One Night, which came out in, I think, 1934 and is considered to be the first romantic comedy. To Jer's earlier points when he was talking about, you know, the casting, the writing, the directing, or the time and place, you know, why was it that successful? I would say yes to all of it. But for me, this is an example of a nearly perfectly written screenplay, because there are no throwaway scenes. Everything, the storytelling is really tight. Everything is funny. It flows really well. And it actually came in under 90 minutes. I watched it again and it was like an hour and 23 minutes or something like that.
Yeah. Just really tight. Yep.
Yeah. I don't know. I honestly don't know how it could be improved upon. Because I think, like everyone has been saying, it's been copied a few times and I think, you know, everyone's kind of sick of seeing it. An example that I had was the movie Boys and Girls that came out in 2000, I believe. And it's, the formula is there, but the roles are kind of reversed. It's the girl who's sort of the Harry like character and the guy who's more of the Sally role. And to me, it didn't really work. I mean, it was really transparent. I saw this storyline immediately. And I was like, this is what When Harry Met Sally looks like in the year 2000. So I don't know.
I think that one thing that we discussed in pre-production a little bit, why we all liked this, and I agree, Lee, that this, I think the screenplay, the writing in this movie is probably the glue that makes all these other ingredients. You know, the casting was great, the directing was great, but really if they didn't have the writing to use, then it wouldn't have gone anywhere. But I think there's a formula that they use that I don't think has ever been used as successfully or maybe even been discarded. And that's kind of this kind of goofy leading guy with Meg Ryan with this very attractive woman. All the other romantic comedies that have kind of come up have been the casts, you know, from the leads to the smallest minor characters have been gorgeous people. And it's made the films shallower. It's made them much.
The McConaughey syndrome.
The McConaughey syndrome, and even, you know, trying to get, I think, with, like, Katherine Heigl's name was brought up earlier, in the previous episode, that, you know, I think a lot of her movies she plays like this goofy character, but she's also a beautiful woman, and the characters in those movies never really went anywhere. Whereas in this movie, it just took itself more seriously than a lot of the other stuff, and it, It knew it was a well-written, it was a smart movie, and it didn't try to, I feel like it didn't water itself down for the audience. Like, it just, you know, it told a really, really good story, and it had some people in it. You know, Bruno Kirby's kind of a funny-looking dude. Billy Crystal's kind of a funny-looking dude. Like, had just kind of average-looking people, you know, I think for the most part.
Yeah.
And I think that really allowed the character, just, it just gave it a depth that doesn't exist, I think, in a lot of romantic comedies today.
Yeah. Like, it made it more relatable.
Exactly.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
It took a lot of the shine off of it. You go see a romantic comedy now and everyone's gorgeous and you're just, there's a wall that goes up between the movie and the audience to know that there is, that you will never be in this world with these beautiful people having these silly problems.
And I think alongside that is the idea that in When Harry Met Sally, there is a different story being told than is normally told in romantic comedies now, where romantic comedies now, there's some kind of pull out of a hat thing that is kind of the crux of the story, and then the characters fall in love around that. He's got amnesia. She's an alien. You know, whatever it is, there's always some kind of...
he's the sperm donor.
There's got to be... There's got to be a gimmick involved. And this one, number one, I don't think it's not telling the story of how two characters fall in love as much as it is telling a story of how two characters become friends and fall in love. And I think that first part of that is much more important to the story than the end. And mm-hmm. I think that it's the two pieces together that really make the heart of that movie so tight. And it's then that first piece is the piece that is inevitably missing from so many romantic comedies in the McConaughey syndrome, where it's how do we make these two people that are going to start the movie hating each other fall in love and presumably get married and have a really great life after the credits roll. And that's all they're concerned about is getting from point A to point B being they love each other. Yay. And
it's the scale of time that When Harry Met Sally has. And it takes place over 12 years.
That's probably a big part of it, too, is that this is where they are in their life and the amount of time that has taken place in their life is significant. And this is not a relationship that happens over 24 hours or a summer or a weekend or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's a great point. I didn't think about that. But and they do – it's so economical the way that they do it. There's just two – 5 years later placards, you know, there's no montage. There's no summary. It's just like, boom, 5 years later, new stuff. And you just assume again, you as the viewer fill in, okay, he's maybe 5 years more jaded. She's maybe 5 years more OCD or, you know, all those things. They're now established in New York. So maybe they're a little bit more financially secure again and all these things. So you just kind of fill in that back. So yeah.
And they give you enough details when they kind of do those 5 years later, 5 years later. They give you enough details to know what happened, but not how it happened. And so it allows the audience to fill in those details. Cause these are experiences that a lot of people in the audience have probably had themselves or know someone who has gone through that. And so they're instantly relatable, like we talked about. And now you have that much more relatability with these characters because like, oh yeah, I mean, maybe I've gone through a divorce or I know someone who's gone or my parents went through a divorce. I know how much that sucks. I know, you know, how much that. This character's world just got rocked, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good point too. That these characters don't exist in this vacuum of this relationship. They have history, they have past issues and things that they have to deal with and address. That scene when all four of the characters are sitting around talking about the wagon wheel table of Bruno Kirby's and Billy Crystal just sort of blows up and. It's not about the wagon wheel table. It's not about anything else except for the baggage that he's still carrying and how he's at this stage of his life that he's gone through divorce and it's messy and there's still emotions and feelings and everything else that's all kind of coped up or bottled up and all that. And Meg Ryan is the person that's there for him and helping him through it. And I mean, it's just a great little, I love that scene and I love how much that shows what their relationship is becoming or is at that moment. And it's so perfectly written too. Just, I mean, it's exactly how I remember feeling it at certain times too. Just, I mean, you're just completely defeated and deflated, and you just kind of, everything brings it up and everything is a prickly point on it. And it's excellent. And I love it.
Poor Bruno Kirby. He just wants his table.
He just wants his wagon wheel table.
Yeah. We've talked about it a little bit, but I do want to talk about the casting. I think great care went into casting this, and I think they did a fantastic job with it. It's so funny. In the first part, we talk about what we would do differently now, but I think essentially we weren't trying to undo anything that they did in the original. We were maybe just trying to pay homage to it and basically respect that original casting choices because they were so good. You know, Billy Crystal, although he was a little bit weird as a college age student, or a college age guy, was just great. I mean, he again was very relatable. He was every guy. You know, he was acerbic. I loved that. I loved that about him. And then Meg Ryan was the perfect counterpoint. You know, again, that sort of established who she was going to be for a long time. And then, I mean, Carrie Fisher is Carrie Fisher. She played that perfectly. And Bruno Kirby, again, being that every man role, similarly, you know, even a little bit more every man-y than Billy Crystal as a supporting person would tend to be. I just think they did such a great job with that. And I just have to give the casting coordinator and casting director and Rob Reiner huge credit for that. And I think that would be, you know, I think the crux of whether a remake would succeed or not would rely almost entirely upon the cast, assuming that we do other things the same as they did in the original. Like some of those ambiguous things that we talk about as a feature, if you will, could be seen as a huge detriment if the performances are not great. Because I think what happens oftentimes in romantic comedies is that because the performances are weak or because the writing is weak, they feel like they have to throw in all this other stuff. And we touched upon that a little bit. But yeah, I just think that, you know, it's such a huge, crucial part of everything. And they did it right from the get-go in the original. All right. So another thing that we mentioned, and we touched on this a little bit, is just that there's no gimmicks in the original. So I think we've talked enough about that, but that was just another point that we had made. Moving on to a segment that we've done before called Been There, Done That. And this time it's kind of Been There, Done That-ish. So there's not been a exact remake of When Harry Met Sally, but Lord knows there's been dozens upon hundreds of movies that have been inspired by When Harry Met Sally. Again, this is kind of the prototypical modern romantic comedy. And so there are so many movies who have been influenced by it. And we're each going to talk about one very briefly that we chose. Some of them are very clearly influenced by When Harry Met Sally, and some are a little bit less so. The one that I spoke of, or the one that came to mind for me, was sort of influenced by When Harry Met Sally's nature of them going apart and coming back together, going apart and coming back together, ultimately falling in love. And this didn't quite end up that same way, but the movie that I chose was Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind with Kate Winslet and Jim Carrey, directed by Michel Gondry. It's one of my favorite movies. It is an extremely unique movie, and it basically kind of upends a lot of those romantic comedy tropes while doing a lot of them at the same time. It's almost like a sci-fi romantic comedy, which sounds very strange, but it totally is. It's just really, really wonderful. It's beautifully acted, beautifully casted. I really can't see anybody else in those two main roles, much like in When Harry Met Sally. So if you haven't seen it, be sure to see it. Shame on you, for starters. But it's really, really wonderful.
I absolutely adore that movie.
Yeah, it's just such an interesting story.
Yeah,
that's one of its main strengths. It is a romantic comedy in a lot of ways, but it's not a romantic comedy story.
Yeah,
in a very different way than When Harry Met Sally, it has a very big heart at the middle of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, in my opinion, was the best movie of 2004.
Yeah,
and in my like overall list of movies, it's in my top 10. Maybe in my top 5.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. Agreed.
Yeah.
Mark, how about you? What did you pick for movies inspired by When Harry Met Sally?
Well, I picked a recent film called The 5-Year Engagement. It's an excellent movie with a lot of our favorite people. Jason Segel, Emily Blunt, Chris Pratt, Alison Brie. And the commonality that I see is that the two main characters spend the duration of the movie basically connected to each other and sort of, you know, and the relationship ebbs and flows and finally get married at the end. But, the twist is that they're actually engaged for pretty much the entire film. and trying to deal with life circumstances and stuff. Yeah. changes the way that they're, yeah, changes their relationship.
Yeah, that's a great movie. I really enjoyed that. From the the performances to the casting, everything was really good and just a lot of fun.
I still have to see that one.
Move that one up in your queue, if you will. Definitely check that one out.
Yeah, will do.
Let's move on to Lee.
Well, the one that I had mentioned was Boys and Girls, which I've touched on already, but it stars Freddie Prinze Jr. and what's her name? Claire Forlani.
Yep.
And they're college students, and it takes place in San Francisco, and they start out friends, and eventually they come to realize feelings for each other and blah blah blah, and it's not a great movie in my opinion. It's entertaining enough to watch, but from the carbon copy storyline of When Harry Met Sally, I mean, the type of story is exactly the same. It's just the specifics and the setting are a little bit different. But from that to the group dance scene, it's not a great example of a romantic comedy, in my opinion. But I don't know. It's mildly entertaining.
Really stand behind your pick there, Lee.
Yeah,
that's all right. It doesn't have to be good. It's just inspired.
Yeah, I'm
by
just
it.
Talking about it. I'm not endorsing it.
Well, I'm not going to vote for Lee's.
Wait, we're voting? What?
What?
But Andy, I think you had something to say about what is it? Juno?
It is Juno. I'm going to say something about Juno. I think this is a movie similar to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Not that it's a sci-fi romantic comedy, but that I feel like it's a romantic comedy with a very unusual story. I like that in this version, the two main characters, their primary relationship is friendship. It just so happens that they one time knocked some boots and got Juno pregnant. But it's very interesting. And they're in high school, by the way, if you haven't seen it. It's a fantastic movie. Go see it. There's a big heart in that one as well, because it's all of a sudden these young kids who are kind of got... You know, one thing led to another this one time, and they never really, it seemed, didn't have a plan to continue that romantic relationship. And all of a sudden we have these consequences of it. And how do you deal with that when you're at this very young age and all these kind of different versions of love that are expressed in the movie? It's very funny. It's very touching. It's a fantastic film, but I like that it's just not another typical romantic comedy. You know, here's two opposites, watch them attract, blah, blah, blah. It's a very unusual twist and not one that I had ever seen before. So Juno.
Yeah, that's a goodie. I haven't seen that in a long time. I need to revisit that. I saw it in the theater and I don't think I've seen it since.
Another one that just the cast from top to bottom is just great. Even the small roles are just so well played.
Yep.
So
now that one to me, I really liked it the first time, and the second time I didn't feel like it held up as much.
Hmm. Interesting.
I feel the same way.
Certain places were good, but then I couldn't stand Jennifer Garner, and I couldn't stand,
I thought Jennifer Garner's character actually was, I thought that, I don't know, I could relate to her character in a way. I think for people who've ever gone through, some people go through a lot of fertility issues trying to have kids, and how almost can, you know, it can make some people kind of desperate and you just yearn for this thing for so much, you know, so intensely. So I related to her character. I could see how she was a little bit annoying because she definitely had a buttoned upness to her. But I like that movie. I'm standing by my pick. So,
well, I'm not going to vote for yours either.
So there, Jer. So tell me about your piece of junk of a movie.
Well, my movie is Sleepless in Seattle that I chose, and that is the movie that I am choosing. It was also directed by Nora Ephron, who directed When Harry Met Sally.
Wrote. Mm-hmm.
She Rob wrote Reiner When Harry Met it. Sally, directed yep. and wrote Sleepless in Seattle. Let me know if any of this sounds familiar. Tom Hanks is an architect. Huh? okay. And Meg Ryan is in it. Mm-hmm. So... And this is this is the second of three or four times that Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan did comedy together.
Mm-hmm.
They were in Joe vs. the Volcano, and then they did You've Got Mail and something else. It has a lot of the same types of qualities that When Harry Met Sally had, although there is a big giant gimmick over the top of it that we kind of talked about, and that is that Tom Hanks' son writes into a radio station because he wants his dad to have a new wife, and a bunch of women all, you know, write back and blah, blah, blah. And then Jonah sort of goes behind, Jonah, his son, goes behind his back and, you know, promises, you know, picks the letter he likes and promises to meet her and so on. And so, I mean, there is kind of this gimmicky nature to the whole thing. What I like about it, for the same reason that I like When Harry Met Sally, is the end of the movie is not the atypical or the prototypical romantic comedy. Now they're in love and everything's going to be great. The end of the movie is that the two main characters meet for the first time, and that's it. They meet, yeah. And you don't know where it's going to go from there, and it is very ambiguous, and I think that's a fantastic way to end that story. You know, maybe they're going to hit it off. Maybe they're going to find out that this is not going to work at all. But I like that that's where they left it. And so that's where that's my inspired by When Harry Met Sally movie.
I like it. Very interesting. I forgot about that. I just assume it's kind of the most generic-y look at it. But that is a little bit different. I like that.
Sounds boring.
Sounds boring. I like You've Got Mail better is the dumbest phrase I've ever said. So just to have a little bit of balance here. So while we've slathered praise upon this movie, and deservedly so, we do have some small bits of umbrage in the Wixian style. So Jer, why don't you start us off with your brief umbrage about the movie?
Well, my umbrage is vast, and it largely is about the entire movie. That's not true. My umbrage is tiny, and it has very little to do with anything. And that is that it bothers me to watch. The one thing I'm bothered with when I watch this movie is that Tom Hanks as a fresh-faced college grad and Tom Hanks as a surly middle-aged man look the exact same. And I realize that in 1980, whatever, makeup, and there's only so much you can do to Billy Crystal. I get mm-hmm. that, but I would have liked to have seen some a little bit more so that I understand that there has been a passage of time.
I love that the equivalent of like putting Billy Crystal in a sweatshirt and jeans suddenly, oh, college grad.
Yeah, a college sweatshirt.
And you poof out his curls a little bit more.
Yep, indeed. I did like the progression of Meg Ryan throughout. I thought hers was pretty good. But yeah, Billy was
She had
not,
some great hair at the beginning of that movie.
Not entirely believable as a college student. Speaking of hair, Mark, do you want to touch on that a little bit?
I would love to touch that hair.
Indeed.
Meg Ryan does have great hairstyle at the very beginning of the movie. It's supposed to be the late 70s or something. And I thought, God, that looks just like Farrah Fawcett hair.
Yep.
I don't actually have any umbrage with the film. I just wrote down the hairstyles just to put something in there.
There you go. That's fair enough. I dig it. It is definitely, I mean, that does age it a little bit. It does feel, like fashion-wise, it does feel a little bit dated. Not terribly so, but a little bit.
The timelessness of this movie is completely lost as soon as you realize what they're all wearing.
Yeah. It's pretty balanced, actually, overall, but it is there a little bit.
I feel like that was simply a device for them to show the passage of time.
Yeah, agreed. Jerry, you also talked about whether the movie would be successful today. Do you want to? That's a kind of a big question, but do you maybe want to give the shortish version of that?
Well, my opinion is if we were to, using our cast that we just took, make a shot-for-shot remake of this movie, it wouldn't be successful. That is my opinion.
I agree.
So you think it was just meant to be at that time, that it couldn't be replicated?
There was something magical about that, everything coming together, and I don't think that it would. I don't think that it would happen again.
Interesting.
And I think some of that has to do with culture now versus culture in the late 80s. You know, the differences and the progression that we have seen in the role women play in movies and men, and how that's changed. And I think it could be successful if it were changed, but if it was this movie and we just reshot it and did it all over again, I can't see it doing well.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all. But I don't quite know why. I don't think it was quite exactly a flash in the pan, but yeah, I think it would be really, really hard. I think it's the form has changed so much while maintaining kind of the, you know, what tied it to that original movie. I just feel like maybe it would be too boring. Like all the things that we love would just be seen as negatives now. I don't know. That's hard to say. It's a really good question. Lee, you had one, it wasn't a umbrage per se, but you did have one suggestion for the movie in regards to the interviews. And actually, we really didn't touch on that, but I loved the little interstitial love stories that they put in there. I thought that was, you know, it really helped separate time. It brought everything together. And it, you know, when there were tough times in the movie, it really brought levity to that too. I thought that was really great. And we didn't really touch on that. But you had an idea of maybe how it could be different for their interview at the end of the movie.
Yeah, I thought it might be interesting to have their interview at the end not be them in their 30s. It's them 40 years later, and they're still married, and they're telling their story. You know, they're talking about how they became friends and then how they fell in love. And then they talk about their wedding a little bit. But I actually did have one little piece of umbrage. It's getting back to the writing. The only thing that I kind of had an issue with is those few scenes at the end where Billy Crystal has voiceover narration, because they're completely out of place. Like, I mean, there's no voiceover in the rest of the movie, so it just seems a little strange. I think in a remake, we could edit those scenes together where they go back and forth between her at the party, him by himself wandering around New Year's Eve in a way that the voiceover maybe isn't necessary.
But yeah.
It's a little thing, but umbrage nonetheless.
Interesting. I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, that was a great discussion, gentlemen. Thank you. So that wraps up here the second half of our discussion of When Harry Met Sally. If you'd like to find out more information about this podcast or any other podcast or blog on the Math is Hard Network, check us out at mathishard.net. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at username mathishardnet. Our next episode will be released on Monday, April 21st, where we'll be tackling a bizarro Remakers Make discussion of Inception, as we talked about. So really excited about that. So, gents, as always, it was a lovely time. And until then, until the next bizarro Remakers, Mark, may the Force be with you.
And also with you.